Hello, you're listening to a spoiler-filled film conversation. Hooray!
Come with us now on a journey through time and space to the dark star. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. Dark Star. That's what we're doing. That's the film. I'm Richard. Hello. With me on the podcast is Anthony.
How do you do?
And Abby.
Hello.
It's the podcast where we have a spoiler-filled film conversation. Who would have thought? Anyway, let's have that conversation now. Abby, you picked the film, so give us the deets.
Okay, we watched Dark Star from 1974. It was directed by John Carpenter. It was also written by him with Dan O'Bannon, who also starred in the film as Pinback. He was joined by Dre Pahish as Talby, Brian Norell as Lieutenant Doolittle, and Cal Cunningham as Boiler.
And
It is about a small crew on a 20-year mission in space, going a bit funny and having stuff go wrong.
that's right, it is about that. So, why this particular film, Abby?
I hadn't seen it before, and it was in the little book of cult. Or alternately, it was in the 501, I can't remember.
501
But
films you should watch before you pass away, you sad twat.
yes. So it was rated, and I hadn't seen it before, and it looked like the kind of thing I'd like.
So are you a John Carpenter fan?
Haven't seen them all. The ones I have seen, I quite liked.
And what about the other writer guy who like wrote Alien and stuff subsequently?
I thought the writing in Alien was quite tight, so I guess I quite like him too.
Yes. What else did he do? Because he got a nice back catalogue of sci-fis actually, starting with this one, I suppose.
Yeah, so it was this, that was Alien, then he was uncredited for Phobia. He did Heavy Metal, which is a bit. Dead and Buried, Blue Thunder, Return of the Living Dead, Life Force, Invaders from Mars, Aliens, Total Recall, Alien Cubed. Alien versus Predator, the video game.
So, what, the
Screamers.
video game, do you say?
Yeah.
Okay.
Screamers, something called hemoglobin, which looks horrible.
Hemoglobin.
Sure,
That's fine, we don't
Batman.
have to read his whole credits. I was just trying to, and obviously John Carpenter's famous for stuff like The Thing, Assault on Precinct 13, Escape from New York. They Live, he's got a whole host of sci-fis and actually he did the John Carpenter also did the previous spoiler-filled choice, one of the Memoirs of the Invisible Man. That's always a random one that he did.
He's come up a few times, actually. I think this podcast may make him joint equal most popular director
That we chat
here at
about.
Spoiler Field. Unless we've done another Peter Hyams.
It's not
I was
impossible.
considering it. But yeah,
Yeah.
I think now he's one of our more prolific guys here on Spoiler Field.
It's not good because we tend to pick middle of the road stuff. But John Carpenter's generally not middle of the road. He's quite an accomplished director and music sort of creator. He does some really weird stuff with music that is often talked about, occasionally replicated by other people.
I
But
think the
anyway.
word you're looking for is composer.
You're a poser. So what you're saying is you fancied this and this was a good excuse, so you wanted to try it out. So you didn't actually know what it was going to be like.
Yeah, I did contrary to my usual and did a film I hadn't seen.
Okay. Anthony, had you heard of or seen Dark Star before now?
I hadn't seen it. The only time I heard about it was a conversation with you, Rich, and I believe you went into pretty much most detail of it, but all I can remember from what you said was kind of like a pre-Red Dwarf, and that told me like enough. Like you didn't have to say anything else. All you had to say is it kind of reminded me of a early Red Dwarf. I'm like, I'm in
Well, yeah,
because I
so
love Red Dwarf and stuff like that. So I was kind of expecting... Well, it's a hard one because it's a cheapy sci-fi film from the 70s. So there's only kind of really two extremes it could have gone. Like, either really bloody funny and good or really cheap and dire and nasty. So like it still easily have gone either way, even with your recommendation, Rich, no offense. But, you know, it's a cheap 70s sci-fi and... You know, but then I do kind of like that kind of atmosphere in old cheapy sci-fi movies that are kind of like set in space and isolated.
You have to work harder to get tension and drama when you have a low budget, isn't it? Because you can't just put silly effects in or have loads of CGI to throw at it, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And to be fair, most of those came after Alien, which was, like, the end of the 70s, and this was a good, like, 5 years before. So, I don't know, I was on the fence. I thought I was going to like it. I was coming in expecting somewhere between, I don't know, something like Alien and then Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy or something.
Hmm. Well, it's good that you say... I talked to you about it, and all you remember is me basically saying it's like Red Dwarf, because I'm going to say that it is an influence... it was an influence, apparently, on Red Dwarf getting made. I think, if the wiki's to be believed, and you can see it. You can watch this film.
Yeah.
You go, oh, there's loads of ideas in this that are kind of key to what Red Dwarf would be later on. So, I mean, I'm obviously a fan of Red Dwarf, so if that's true, then I should be interested in this. And, yeah, so I'm going to elaborate more, and presumably the listeners, along with you, once again, will forget what I said. But hopefully retain that one thing that will get them to watch it, they haven't.
Not forget, I remembered the important bit.
Oh, we've had endless conversations about films, so it's fair enough.
I should also say that fan of John Carpenter as well, so... Even his lesser stuff, I still kind of like. So I thought I would like this film. Anyway.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I like John Carpenter. And I had seen this before Abby suggested it. I think, like you, Abby, it was like one of those, oh, you should watch this, it's a cult film. And I was like, yeah, I'll get on that eventually. And I did. Mm-hmm. And I was very pleased. I knew you guys were going to enjoy it. Mm. But it could have been... It could have been in small patches, it could have been the whole thing. But personally, I really like this film. And it's a testament to how amazing you can be with like your first attempt at a film. Especially, like, I think the idea is... So John Carpenter and Dan O'Bannon made this, and it was a student film that then later on got added to make it into like a full film. And so, as a first film, it's really quite creative and impressive. But then, generally, it's, like, quite flimsy and low budget. Mm. So, you know, it could leave people going, oh, God, what is this poorly filmed? No, it's not poorly filmed, exactly. It's just low quality. You know, I don't know, you might think it's low quality, but then you go, shit, it's really high quality if you know how cheap it was. So, like, very creative if you consider the budget. Yeah, I was looking forward to watching it again. So we all have. We've all watched it now. So let's get into, you know, basically why it's so fucking brilliant, guys. It's great. I love this film. It's funny. It's imaginative. I want to live in the universe that they've created.
Which is quite, I don't know about that.
It is very dystopian in a sense. Like I personally don't want to live in it. I want more stuff set in this scenario, which is kind of the Red Dwarf world in many respects. I like the kind of world they create with such a small window into it as well. So
yeah, even stuff like small stuff. Like I think the film starts where they receive a message on a monitor from like Earth, and. Mm. It just kind of explains their situation nice and quickly. You know, they're on the Dark Star, they're exploring, they're blowing up erroneous planets whatever what that was about, and they'd be gone a long time. And then, but also, you also get the attitude of society towards them as well.
Yeah.
And it's all quite neat and in that first little explanation. And it's not just, you know, oh, guys, here's what's happening, exposition. It's just a nice, done neatly way. It's kind of, they just kind of throw in the little bits you need subtly into the conversation.
Yeah. It is it's a black and white, straight on filmed vlog or whatever that's been sent to the 4-man crew on Darkstar, which is the name of the spaceship. As you mentioned, it's kind of 20 years into deep space, and they're sort of destroying planets for colonization, potentially dangerous or eroding, or planets that are going to kick up a fuss.
So, unstable.
Yeah. So they're kind of...
I think I prefer kick up a fuss, actually.
Problematic planets that they can sort of get. They're bulldozing, essentially, for future colonization is the gimmick that they're out there for. But it's, you know, it's four 70s-looking hairy dudes who've been in space for years, just knocking around in the vast expanse. And they're getting a little...
They're also experiencing a lot of cabin fever as well. Yeah, as you would,
yeah. So, yeah, but I like the vlog you get from Earth, because it is just an official, you know, filling us in and telling them a bit. And they mention the fact that he was sad to hear the news that one of the crew members the superior crew member has been killed off, or seemingly killed, and that there was a week-long parade on Earth. And you just kind of go, no, there wasn't. No, there wasn't. The Earth doesn't even know. Like, it's not explicit that he's lying to them, but it seems like a complete propaganda-like lie to make them feel good and make them feel cared for in a kind of sad corporate way. Like, did anyone else feel like that when the guy said, "Oh, there was a week-long parade in honor of him because he was killed," and like they all their hearts go out to them? It just felt like it was bullshit from the corporate top dogs.
Oh yeah, and that's kind of why it was a really good start as well, because you've got it, haven't you? You've got the kind of capitalist expanding space empire thing going on, and then you instantly get his attitude to them, and I don't know, it's just very neat and quite, you know, funny as well.
Yeah, it sort of suggests as well, if they did care about you, why there's such a shitty brief video with no photographs of people like celebrating the life of this guy, no proof that happened, just a man saying, "Oh yeah, you're doing great, and we're sending no supplies to help you. We know you've lost all your toilet paper. A section of the ship needs more shielding or something. You're not getting any of that stuff. We can't afford it. I'll be asked." Did you like this opening, Abby? Do you think it was an interesting way to fill us in on what's going on?
Yeah, it was really refreshing to compared to the Martian, where you had those four astronauts who basically turned their ship around to go back and get him. And it's very sort of like in films now, it's, "Oh, we're going to rally around, we're going to save you guys." But back then it was, "Nope, can't afford it, don't want to.
It's nicely cynical, isn't it? It's like a cynical interpretation of how the future would go. Yeah. And also, there's occasionally the diary entries, which are similar looking. I think Pinback is the one we see recording diary entries. Although, we get... Doolittle does like an update for the people back on Earth as to what's been going on. And Pinback interrupts that to say, "I'm not happy about sitting next to where the guy died and stuff." And so that we get a little bit of a sense of these guys sending messages back and the diaries they keep. And Pinback's was particularly funny. I mean, there's revelations within his one. But I like the straight-on kind of Big Brothers, sit in the chair and do the thing and talk, you know, to camera. I think that's a nice way to correspond with Earth in a kind of straight, like sci-fi but low-tech kind of way, because they're so far away, you can kind of understand it.
It was a good way to mix up the visuals as well, because you're dealing with such few actors in a confined space. To have different ways to look at them is really helpful.
Yeah. Although, I don't know quite how the post works, if they're 20 years into the thing, you know, it must take ages for correspondence. That's what they suggest. I don't quite know.
I can't remember what they said, but it implied that they're only getting messages every, like, 5 or 10 years, or every year or something.
Yeah. All the more
it's
reason.
It's to do with how long the signal takes to get back to Earth.
Mm.
So it's the signal getting back, and then the signal from Earth getting to the ship. Getting further and further apart.
Hmm. Well, yeah, so the interior of the ship is very confined because their sort of working area is like a huge, like, two-sided light-up switch. You know, it's a spaceshipy looking interior, but they're really, like, I think they're, like, two facing one way, another facing the other. They all got switches all around them, and they're very much cramped and just, you know, pushing buttons and doing stuff and talking to the computer, and you know, it's not that Star Trek thing where you can walk around a bit and look out a giant window. These are just guys in a tiny cramped cubicle scenario, isn't it?
Mm. It was much more like a submarine, and I like that.
Yeah, it's cool
because it was sort of like, it's like a spiritual cousin to Das Boot in a way.
Hmm. And we there's a sense that these guys are, you know, partly not dummies, but they're not very important, and they might be believing that they're like, it's not that they think they're important, it's just that they're going along with all this and not really questioning how important it is what they're doing and how much respect they're getting. They don't really care. They seem like schlubby, not caring guys. They're not, you know, heroic space adventurers. These aren't your typical sci-fi heroes like you get in, like, Star Trek again. You know, these are schlubs doing their job, and they're not very inspired people. At least it seems that way, because they cut, like, what is it? One of them discovers a star on the computer, and then Doolittle, who's the senior member, he doesn't even want to name the star. He doesn't give that much of a shit. He can't even be asked to name a new star. It's like the whole thing is mundane to them, exploring space, isn't it?
Hmm.
Well, not all of them, because...
True.
Like, was it Pinback that got the ship? He was like, the commander would have named it. So he's the last one with any dregs of wonder left, I think.
But then, no, the guy on top, really, is the one who's sort of so... He's blown away by space. He's like the guy who sits on the top. What's his name? Tulby?
Yeah.
Is that his name? Tolby?
I think so.
But he sits there endlessly viewing the stars. So he's got the emotional interest in space, and it's possibly, again, the stir crazy thing. Has he just been staring out at space for so long he's gone mad? But but generally, in contrast to general sci-fi, these aren't, you know, sailing through space adventurers. These are doing a job, guys. These are, you know, you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of easy to take granted these days, since we've had films like Alien and Blade Runner, where it kind of depicts the future in that way. Mm. But back in the mid-70s, like, the bigger films, you know, would have been the Star Trek films and Space Odyssey. And, you know, they're all big and colourful and flashy, and they're all about space fights, and this is totally different to all of that, which is kind of lost these days, because it's much more saturated these days, sci-fi, with films like that, darker and grimmer and with different kinds of people. But it might have been, at the time, a much more of a revolutionary thing. I can't think of many other films like that until, like, Alien came along.
Yeah, and obviously there's a good reason Alien came along in the way that it did, because the guy wrote this first, so...
Yes, this... essentially, like, it kind of... Parts of this do feel like a, like, parody version of Alien, even though it's, like, made 5 years beforehand.
Yeah, it's essentially a prototype for what would be Alien, isn't it, in some ways. Only, well, we'll get to it. So there's Pinback, who is your Arnold Rimmer of the group, I guess. But no, he's the... I would say he's fastidious, but he's not really. He's a bit more sort of focused on...
Go on. I think he's supposed to be the more relatable one to the audience.
What do you think?
I do, just because he has normal reactions to things, or at least what we perceive as normal. Like, everyone else is bummed out and sad-looking all the time. But, like, this guy at least, you know, he's got some humour, even if it's not quite there. Like, oh, he's God. Getting, like, he's getting
his
weird.
His attempts to make him laugh. Eyes. Yeah. The googly eyes and the rubber. He just has a rubber chicken, and he's like, it's funny. And it's like, no, Fozzie Bear. No, it's not funny.
And because this is like essentially at the beginning, and we as an audience haven't experienced like 20 years of isolation,
yeah.
Where, you know, we're going to relate to him. He's the one who we're more like. Everyone else is, you know, sad and depressed. So I think we're supposed to latch on to Pinback because of that.
He at least wants the thing to go more correctly as well. He sort of he wants his colleagues to engage with his anecdote, to listen to him. He has wants and desires outside of just blowing up planets and killing time, or I don't know. Like, he seems more focused, I guess. Abby, what did you think of Pinback? How would you articulate who he was?
Yeah, I'm in line with what you're saying, but then, like, one of the jokes was about how he told that anecdote 2 years ago. But yeah. He doesn't remember that he told it. It makes it more tragic because we sort of root for him, but we also know that he's going to become them if it goes on much longer.
Mm. Yeah, and he's still a little bit childish and petty, and he's also sort of like the way he behaves when he has to deal with the alien on the spaceship. That it was his suggestion they take an alien on board to sort of. As a project, and it's turned sour on him because he doesn't get on with it anymore, and it's like his resistance. He's like a child. Oh, do I have to deal with this? So he's sort of childish and I don't know what the right word is. Like, not pathetic. Oh, there's a word I'm looking for, and it's just the right sort of petulant,
naive.
Yeah, he's naive, a bit petulant or something. So he has a lot of limitations to him as well. And one of the big revelations is through the diaries, like, you see him with like less hair and you think he's smoking. And then as the diaries progress through time, you get a picture of the story of him. And it basically isn't this Pinback character. He's wearing his clothes and is on the mission. Not, like, through error, essentially. I think part of the story he was telling was about the guy Pinback, or... No, I can't quite remember who... Like, did he replace Pinback because Pinback was killed? But for whatever reason, he's on the ship in place of Pinback, and has presumably at some point assumed his identity just because they've been 20 years and they've stopped... it almost doesn't matter anymore if he's Pinback or not.
Yeah, I couldn't quite tell if that was his way of sort of, like, you know how Klinger kept trying to say, sorry, you know how Klinger in the MASH TV show kept trying to get himself thrown out of the army for dressing like a woman? Hmm. If Pinback was trying to do a similar thing by saying he wasn't Pinback because he didn't want to go?
Right. I don't think it was quite that. It's almost that same, like, we're so used to you being this way. We only accept you now as you are. So who cares? And obviously, he, you know, whoever sent them on this mission, they haven't altered him. They haven't said, "Oh, we better get you back if you're not the right person." But I liked sort of the joke of it all, and what I just like what it implies about their universe and the state they're in. It's very much about stir craziness, isn't it? It's like a piece about men who've been in a confined space and they've been in a confined space in the vast expanse of empty space, and all they do now is go, like, they ask the computer where the nearest planet that is potential to be blown up, and they go and blow it up. And it's like, Doolittle seems to be the only thing that interests him is going to blow up the next planet. To the, like, there's no scientific interest, there's no, you know, exploration like there's even finding life doesn't seem like a thing he's interested in. Like they talk, I think there's a thing where there's a sort of small percentage of finding life on a planet they can get to, and it's like, oh, it won't even be worth it. Remember the last time it was so underwhelming, you know? I think those are kind of fair enough observations as well. Like, chances are we find life on another planet. Oh, it's just algae. Great.
Mm.
What did you guys make of Doolittle then? See, this have brought him up.
Well, when he was complaining about, like, it probably wouldn't even be proper life anyway, it did sort of remind me of you. It very much had stuff that you'd like, was that attitude to thing. Well, not so much the blowing shit up, though.
Well, I very much would name a star. Any opportunity to name a star and be like, kumquat blamange penis, the star. Like any like any opportunity to think of a funny phrase to call something that gets recorded officially. And that's the sun, then, of a planet in the future. Some, and I've called it panda balls or whatever. So, I did, you know, I could relate to Doolittle, certainly. You know, fabulous afro and beard combination. He had probably the biggest afro of, well, no, he's the only one with an afro, really. The others all had shaggy 70s hair and beards of some description, or moustaches. Anthony, what do you think of Doolittle? He was kind of the leader as well, so.
He was, but yet he's the one I kind of don't remember the most. I pretty much, it's weird, other than Pinback, my resounding memories are the other three of them just kind of sitting around and looking sad. Apart from the other guy who is grooming himself.
The blonde guy with the longer hair.
The horseshoe moustache. What was his name? I can't remember his name.
Boiler.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so Boiler had the horseshoe moustache and a penchant for fucking around with the laser gun, so he sort of dicks around a lot more. He seems the most carefree, and he's quite preening, as you mentioned. But I think he's the least developed one. I would say Doolittle has more going for him because he interacts with the cryogenically frozen previous captain or whatever.
The commander.
The commander, yeah. What's his name?
Commander Powell.
Okay. Thank you. So the cryogenically frozen ex-commander, Commander Powell, he has a chat with him, and he also asks to negotiate with the bomb. So I feel like Doolittle does a bit more. So he's not that. I would say,
for the purpose of the listeners, I think you should probably explain the phrase "negotiate with the bomb."
Well, we'll be getting to that. I think that's probably my favourite bits of the whole film involving the bomb.
Yeah, because essentially we got four main characters, but then we got kind of three, outside of the people corresponding from Earth, or the one guy, there's three other characters, and it's the cryogenically frozen ex-commander who's sort of, he's been sort of killed, but he's being contained cryogenically in an ice cubey thing with a sort of computer hooked up to him. So they could sort of talk to him into his psyche or something. And then we got the computer that basically does the hard, heavy lifting of running the ship. They seem to need to press buttons to set the bombs off. But fundamentally, the computer has this lovely, caring woman voice that does most things for them, including playing nice music to make them feel a bit more pleased or keep morale up. And just it sort of has a tone to suggest it's babysitting them. And then we've got the bombs. The bombs seem to have an ability. They sort of have their own artificial intelligence and can talk. So we got these weird side characters outside of the four crew members. And they're all kind of the really interesting parts, I think. They all provide us with the most interesting. Oh, and then we got the alien, which is a beach ball with paint on it and little webbed feet.
Yes, I think we should state that it actually was a beach ball with
we're not being
feathers and webbed feet.
It's not
that wasn't just you being very descriptive. It was literally a beach ball,
a painted beach ball with webbed duck feet or something. Yeah. Okay, well, it's one of the first things that happens to them is they have a thing where they go through a bizarre asteroid field with possibly some kind of electronic shit going on, and that causes some problems. But one of the first sort of dramatic narrative parts is Pinback needing to feed the alien, and he does it begrudgingly. Well, because they spend some time just bored and finding things to do, like sunbathing indoors, or like, what is he sunbathing, or is he just like wearing a tropical shirt and hanging out in the corridor?
Let's assume he was under some sort of lamp.
Yeah, there's a lot of mulling about, we're bored stuff going on. And yeah, the computer chimes in with, oh, you need to feed the alien that you brought on the ship, and you have to do it. It's your responsibility. See, it's like a kid with a pet hamster they've long since stopped caring about because it's shit. But Pinback has to feed the beach ball. Does anyone want to elaborate on what happens to Pinback and the ball and the kind of Bugs Bunny-like story that happens?
I don't know if it's just sort of like playing a bit rough or if it's trying to kill him.
Yeah, I think of it as like a slightly malicious pet where it doesn't want him dead per se, but it's playfully... I mean, he tries to feed it a cabbage and it's not interested. Oh, so yeah, so Pinback has lost interest, and I think that if we're going to assume an inflatable beach ball has emotions that we're buying into, you could say maybe this pet alien has become, well, if you're not interested in me and you're just going to try and feed me a cabbage and fuck off while I'm bored, maybe it's a form of entertainment, maybe it's slightly vindictive. I don't think it's maliciously trying to kill him. It's not like actual alien.
No, I think it's the general thing with kind of wild animals. It's like, there's going to be that kind of doubt. Are they playing with me or are they trying to kill me? In which case, are they necessarily separate things?
You could say the alien is not going to play ball with him. But yeah, so go on.
I was just going to say, this was it was a fun section of the film. A little out of place, but I'm glad it was there. But yeah, like this scene, like I said before, like this scene mostly is a kind of feels like a parody of like aliens, like, you know, being stalked around the spaceship by the alien that you can't find.
Only it's a beach ball.
Yeah, and it's a weird thing how it plays out. Like at first, it is kind of like a weird Looney Tunes cartoon with, you know, the ball kind of like jumping at it and, you know, making it look like he's trying to attack him, and then they go like searching, and then there's a really weird bit like in an elevator shaft, which I don't know why it works, because it's really slow and really kind of crap, and yet I was really glued to the screen at this point.
Yeah, I don't know how they did that either. It was just so, you're not in danger. But I'm really anxious right now.
There was some peril. Like, Pinback, when the ball escapes from its room and he has to try and locate it and find it, and it's sort of playing silly buggers with him, it does eventually end up with him following him kind of diehard style through a giant vent and into an elevator shaft. And then he's sort of caught up on the elevator and dangling from it and being continually fucked because he's trying to get back on the ledge and he can't climb in and he can't... like, he eventually does climb into it, but it's plays out quite well. It's shot from above sometimes, and different angles make it more interesting. And there's a tension there, like, there's a genuine...
Yes. You know. It's remarkably tense for, like, just how slow and little is happening.
And how silly it sort of is because of the type of alien it is. So what's interesting about it is it's stupid and comedic and, like, it's like Daffy Duck being fucked over or something. But there's also a sense of he could die. Like, when it comes really close to his face and then it goes up and he's dangling and, it, like, there's elements where he's... potentially going to fall and be killed or be crushed to death or break an arm or a limb. But then he also has the moment where he's halfway into the elevator and he's just desperately trying to use the buttons and free himself from the sort of maintenance hole he's in. And then it sort of, he's going to get free, but it has to explode to let the door off. But he doesn't die, he's wearing it like a tutu. So it's like, oh, this is silly and not meant to be taken like a life or death thing then.
I think what made it really tense for me is because there were so few of them on the ship and he'd gone so far, is that he'd never be found. Be found, like, too late.
That's exactly what I was just about to say. Like, that's because it's so open and dark and grey everywhere. And you get the idea that if he does do something to himself, that's it. Like, no one's going to come looking for him.
And we even have the other story later where the guy who likes looking at space, he is injured and he's forgotten about and ignored. So they are a kind of careless, carefree, strange crew of people who don't have that much thought for anyone else's safety or what anyone else might want to say or do. But my favourite bit is he comes out of the elevator all peeved because this alien's got the better of him. And then there's like music, like almost to emphasise how determined he is. And he storms to like a special box and he gets out like a dart gun or something and he just shoots the ball and it deflates as a beach ball should and zips around the room. And it's just what's he say? Something like, oh my God, there's a great line and I can't remember. It's worth watching just to hear him just call it say it's going to meet its maker, the sad little shit or whatever he says. There's just this, I love the determined look on Pinback's face as he's reached the breaking point, essentially.
And so he didn't mean to kill it, did he?
I think he was a bit taken aback that it just deflated. It was just like, it just literally was full of air. It's like, yes, of course it was. I think he was expecting blood or gore or something, or who knows.
But no, he was using a tranquilizer gun.
So maybe.
So I think he was just expecting it to be tranquilized, and then it sort of semi-exploded.
Yeah, deflated. A very deflating situation. But it is an odd, it sticks out because A, the alien's a ball, but also because it's so much like a cartoon. Whereas the other elements of peril and danger are treated a bit more seriously. But I wouldn't want it removed or anything. I think it's great. So this electrical storm causes malfunctions. And then also there's like a laser that's been bumped or needs fixing. And that's being neglected and being made worse by the alien putting his hand in and like touching it and doing stuff. So essentially this ship is it's a worn out ship anyway. It's already had problems in the past. It hasn't been repaired by the neglecting corporation that sent them out there. And so the ongoing story is of the bombs being lowered from the bomb bay and starting the detonation sequence. But then having to be told to go back in and overridden by the computer or negotiated to by the crew. Does anyone want to talk about the kind of bomb scenario?
Yeah, I think these are, like you said, like they're kind of like the main plot point, I suppose, of the whole film is these bombs that might go off. And they're my favourite parts of the film. The first time it happens, it's quite quick. I think they go through a some sort of space storm.
Yeah, for like a go.
And like it causes the bomb to malfunction, and then it figures that it's been told to go and blow up something, and it's going to do it, and then the computer tries to reason with it. It's like, no, you haven't been sent this information. There was a fault. Please come back in. And like the bomb is just so ready to go. Like, no, I want to blow up. And
yeah, the bomb has an oddly haughty tone to it as well. It's not like an aggressive, oh, I want to destroy. It's, I am programmed to do this. I am a bit dismayed that you're telling me not to. It's so unwilling to go back.
Also, just a little trivia. It was voiced by Dan O'Bannon.
Okay.
The bomb.
Yes. Cool.
Also, the alien was played by Nick Castle, who also played Mike Myers in the Halloween films.
You say played by? It inflated by? Like what?
Well, I don't really know how he did it. Is he the noises or is he the puppeteer? I just went played by.
Well, the hands moved. The feet were hands in like gloves.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing it was that.
Mike Myers.
Cool.
The tone reminded me of the second computer they had in Blake 7. The one with the little remote control, and they kept taking it out because it was annoying as fuck.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. But, like, they had Zen, which was the ship, and then they had the little... what was his name? God, that's vexing. Yeah, Blake 7 had a little box computer that was good at problem-solving, that was very haughty, and, oh, this is not... wasting my programming and stuff, wasn't it? Yeah, it was cracking.
Yeah, but I think I like these sections more. Because they're very reminiscent. It feels like straight out of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, like a Douglas Adams wrote these scenes, you know, and tried bringing in all these concepts of like philosophy and life, and you're just trying to kind of talking to a bomb. I don't know. It's just that kind of weird humor that comes from the absurdity of the situation.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Just these. I think these scenes were the most. I don't know, they were the best. They reminded me of other things I like, and I feel like they were some of the more Red Dwarfy bits as well.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean. Well, like, it reminded me of, say, the toaster in Red Dwarf, or the drinks dispenser, something like that.
Hmm. Well, you know, there's lots of, even the alien ball is a bit like Red Dwarf, because it's something that would be bothering Rimmer or something, isn't it? They're all very reminiscent of that sort of thing. I think what's key to the bomb being put back in the bomb bay and not going off is the computer has the ability to override it. So it can't argue with that. It's got the override code. That's official. Back in I go. And then the computer, who's basically looking after them all and doing it, like it tells them, oh, there's an error, guys. We're going to take off your recreational music a sec. You need to press some buttons if you're going to survive. So can you do that for me? There we go. And then it's like, there's moments where the computer, like, I don't know, they freeze and they do sci-fi shit to save themselves being blown up or not being far enough away from an explosion and having the, like, surviving the problems that the ship is having. And after a while, the ship is so damaged she can't look after them anymore, and just to sort of apologises and abandons them in her own death, but still trying to function and take care of them, even while she's dying.
One of my favourite moments was, throughout the film, they hadn't spoken over each other at the same volume as each other, so it was very much serial speech. But then when they're actually in danger, they start talking all over each other and being really animated, doing the buttons and everything, and there's other sounds. And it was just that very sudden intensity of noise that gave you a really good sense of what danger they were in.
Yeah, the panic stations, it was just them all talking and flicking buttons, yeah. And then it's back to, okay, we're good now. We can all ignore each other and be self-involved.
It also gave you a sense that at some point they were professional.
Yeah, they can do this job, but they have subsequently been in space too long and have become disinterested and, you know, then they're seemingly a bit thick, so they let everything get... and like, just everything becomes a bit lax, generally. I know, there's also, like, the fact that they're not good colleagues. They're colleagues, but they're not good friends and a team. They're just men assigned to this job, so there's kind of things that rub each other wrong all the time because they've been together for so long as well. I can't quite remember why the computer gets properly damaged, because initially it's sort of managing to get by, but is it the fact that the alien knocks the laser, or is it...
It's like that laser, like, isn't Towel B, he goes off to fix it and then it kind of like blows up on him.
Yeah, there's a bit...
And then that kind of causes the computer malfunction, is that right?
Yeah, he sort of is the only person. He's up in the observatory, sort of on top of Dark Star, while the three guys are in the switch button room. And he's always, like, his thing, he sits in his little egg seat and watches space and is a bit zoned out. I think there's a conversation with Doolittle goes up to give him his little square grey meal of whatever it is. And they have a little chat. And basically Doolittle talks about how he misses surfing and doesn't listen to her, the telling thoughts that Tolby's like spouting about space and stars and stuff. They sort of ignore each other and talk to each other at the same time. And Tolby is the only one, when the computer's saying about, well, basically it's the laser needs fixing, or and it's something they should do, but Doolittle's sort of irresponsible and doesn't care about it and just wants to leave it and thinks it'll be fine. And so Tolby sort of sensibly goes to fix it, and but everyone doesn't pay attention to him being in there and doesn't. And I think Dolby cuts off his mic because he's bothering him, because they're having a separate issue. Like, they're trying to deal with their problem, and they dismiss Tolby, and that's what causes the sort of bump in the wrong, in the laser room, and fucks things up, I guess, isn't it?
And isn't there a second electrical storm as well?
Yeah, there's definitely a few little things that not have knock-on effects to the whole downfall of the computer, and then essentially the bomb comes down for, I think it's the third time, and needs to be, and they can't make it come up, the computer can't do it. I think Pinback tries to get it to go back in, and it doesn't work, and he's re-fucked off, and he gets quite petulant with it, and he can't convince it, and then Doolittle has to go and talk to the cryogenically frozen ex-commander.
Commander Powell.
Commander Powell, yes. And it's quite an interesting scenario, isn't it? That you're essentially, you've died or nearly died. You've been cryogenically frozen, and as time goes by, you become like, Powell has become more disorientated. When he communicates, like, he's in a block of ice or whatever, in a certain room in the ship, and with a little bit of apparatus, Doolittle can sort of talk to him, but there's a lot of lag and delay. Powell is very slow to respond and a bit kind of out of it, because he's essentially, it's just his mind half awake in a dream or something.
They made it so simple a technology that you could buy into it, that it's just, he is frozen. There is a microphone. But when you actually think about it, you're like, wait, what? But I really liked the way that they did it, and the way that he looked. Like, if this wasn't a comedy, that would be one of the creepiest things ever.
Yeah. There's this, like, naked... No, you can't see him fully. You just sort of see him from above, looking up slightly. And it's just this, like, naked man frozen in a block who is slowly communicating via wires to his mind or something.
And he complains as well that they only ever come and talk to him when they've got a problem.
Yeah, it's a wonderfully dark and sad psychological query to have, isn't it? Just that they are just a load of fuck-ups and losers, and it's just the fact that the psychological ramifications of someone who's possibly dead or near death, being held indefinitely, and the fact that they'd be slowly going mad in a different way to all the other crew. Like, it's a new kind of stir crazy, and he obviously he knows there's a problem, they're going to die if he doesn't help solve it, but he doesn't really concentrate on what Doolittle's saying, and Doolittle's trying to be patient, but is limited for time because the bomb is threatening to explode after a certain amount of time. So they just have to have a slow conversation about what we should do. The upshot being, go out and talk to the bomb, man to bomb. Because if Pinback's doing a shit job over the, I guess, the town, I don't know why bombs have to be rigged to have thoughts and words. Like, it's funny and it's interesting, but it doesn't practically make any difference. Like, why would you need the bombs to be able to talk?
I just want to give props to the actor Brian Norell, in the scene he's Doolittle, and he was basically recreating every conversation anyone's ever had with their half-deaf gran. It's like, yeah, but we were talking about that, yeah? No?
Oh, you mean with, like, Powell in the cryo freeze, in the frozen ice cubey thing?
Yeah.
Does that cap stay on point? We're going to die, gran. We don't have time for you to... Yeah, it's just that thing of, you know, only ever talk to me when you want something. Yeah. But yeah, he has to have a man-to-man chat with the bomb. So he puts on his little spacesuit, goes out. Meanwhile, you know, Tolby's half knocked out somewhere in the laser room. And Pinback and Boiler are both frantically trying to stop the bomb exploding in the sort of control room. And then probably the best conversation, like philosophizing with a bomb, whether it exists or not, supposing scenarios where can you trust the information you've got? How do you know you exist? How do you know I exist? How do you know there's a command to explode? I mean, everyone must have thought this was a cracking little bit.
Oh yeah, like totally inspired, like I said, just totally inspired by Douglas Adams. And it just captures the sci-fi and the comedy and the absurdity, and it's just great. Like, I don't really know what to say other than it was just so fun to watch.
And the tension is there because there's the bomb's going to explode. If the conversation goes right to the wire, and the bomb eventually gives in and has to, it doesn't so much agree, but says, I need more time to think. And the wonderful bittersweet thing is it goes away and it goes, I'll go back in. They're all relieved. But it hasn't fully made up its mind. So it still, as it turns out, plans to explode. Because I think it comes to the conclusion that if I don't know anything beyond me exists...
He can only trust his own instincts.
And then there's the wonderful parallel, like, I am... the universe, and essentially how the universe was created is it was an explosion. So essentially the bomb assumes it is the only thing that exists and therefore has to explode to become, I guess, the universe is the implication. That's a wonderful like tie-in to the way the universe supposedly comes about with a big bang. So they're all fucked, essentially, in the end. But not quite. But yes, they are still. Because I think Powell goes, like, weirdly, the ice cube survives and goes floating off into space. That's one. Pinback and Boiler are fucked.
Yeah, they're not.
Doolittle, who is in a spacesuit outside, has been jetted off to a safe distance. And because... Oh, no, that's it. When Doolittle, like, once again, flagrantly disregards etiquette and the rules, wants to go in the quick way, and therefore the airlock shoots Tolby out into space in his spacesuit, and Doolittle has to go chasing after him to get him back. But luckily that means they're out of the blast zone for the spaceship, isn't it?
Well, you say lucky. Yeah. It would have been luckier if they just did die.
But it's weird because they have a conversation and Doolittle doesn't like seem that fazed by it. He breaks the news to Tolby that the other two have just died in the explosion. And... that they're heading in different directions thanks to some kind of momentum. And there's nothing they can do. They're just going to die in the vacuum of space. But then they have the little touches that are kind of nice, because Tolby becomes one with some astral star thing that he's been talking about. Like, he's mentioned a thing that goes round the space forever and is a bit weird, like a weird space phenomenon. And he joins it and becomes it. And is happy because he just stared at the stars all the time anyway. So he's floating through time and space as a part of an astral field, asteroid thing or whatever it is. The weird stars. And, you know, Doolittle gets to do some surfing on a bit of detritus from the spaceship.
Yeah.
Before he inevitably burns up in the atmosphere. But he gets a little bit of surfing in before he dies. And that they have the reprieve.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. Yeah, because he kept mentioning going surfing, didn't he?
Yeah, he was all for the back, being back in California or wherever he was from.
Mm.
But the music that plays as well, there's what early on to set the tone of the film is kind of country music, and it's very slow and
The opening song, I forgot about that.
I can't remember the place name that they were singing about, but it's just like I don't know, Arkansas or Alabama or somewhere in it.
Yeah, but you're right. It's a very kind of
boom, 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 boom,
poppy country song. Yeah. And you don't quite know where the film's going to go then because of that kind of opening.
It's a nice contrast to the cool sci-fi. Like, this is a space thing, and it's like lame country music from Earth. Mm-hmm. I think I like that about it. And they have it a bit towards the end, I think. And generally, the music's quite good because it's John Carpenter and he's brilliant at that stuff. So there's some of the atmospheric music is important to sci-fi in future, but it's there. Like, early on in this first film, you got the ability to make synthy noises that sound right. But it's a very bleak... So, basically, everyone's dead. Those who aren't dead are going to be dead or have moved into scenarios that are much too weird to contemplate.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh. And it's weird because they kind of deserve it because they were such a poorly managed crew. They were kind of disregarding rules too often. But they weren't treated well by their corporate... Whoever's in charge of them, didn't really care about them. So they slightly deserve it, but it's very hard to accept the ending, really, bleak as it is.
Well, exactly, because you knew from the beginning that they were going to die.
How do you mean?
Because of the way that the scenario was set up. In that opening message, he said that we're sorry that we're not going to send you any more radiation shielding and that we're sorry that the ship is broken. And it's like, well, if they haven't got radiation shielding, they're going to die.
Well, no, it's not. I don't think... whatever it was, I think they had enough to be getting on with, but they were repairs that needed to be done. But they had to just manage with it. I think it's like when a car fails its MOT and is still drivable, They were expected to carry on with their job. I don't think they were definitely expecting to die. I think it was just a disappointing revelation that they were deep in space and no one was going to do anything about it. They just were supposed to carry on.
Like, in a way, it's the perfect ending to the film.
Yeah.
The way the film played out, I think they all kind of had to be destroyed. Like, at the end, the ship had to be destroyed. And again, if you think about it, at the time when it was released, it would have been even more of a shock. It's just like, oh, they're all just... Everyone's just dead.
It's an upbeat tone because it's sort of comedic. But it's pessimistic and sad.
Mm.
And it's also... But I think, in a way, what were they living for? Like, they'd spent 20 years doing this. They'd all gone a bit mad. And essentially, who were they doing it for? They must be losers who don't have anything to live for. Because they didn't... There was no sense of, I have people back home. There was no... Like, loads of sci-fis of this nature, even if the hope is false, they've got something to live for. They go, eventually I'll go home. Eventually I'll have enough money to do what I want. It's like, I'm doing the mundane dreg job that is just boring and I've lost all interest in space because I've been doing it for so long. But eventually I will go back to Earth. Be sending money to my family. None of these men explain any motivation for why they're there. They're just men in space who've been doing it for years, so there's no big loss to the world in a sense, is there? Because there's no reason why anyone cares about them,
Poignant and fitting, if a little hard to take.
Yeah. And we've seen these guys do stuff like Pinback has fought Boiler over whether he should fire the laser at the piece of lead or whatever that he's put in the corridor really dangerously to shoot, and they have their conversations and moments together where they bicker or get on or ignore each other. But yeah, just four crazy narcissists in space. You can't start to really be disappointed that they're gone. Apart from, we've got to find them amusing, and they're still people, I suppose. And what happened to, you know, Powell? He's still frozen. He could be picked up. Nope, there's no one in that area of space, is there? How long does it take to thaw out in space? Could it be frozen?
No, you wouldn't. Yeah.
No, the Talby said that he's going to burn up when he hits the atmosphere. That's way to die.
That was in reference to Doolittle doing his surfing into the planet that he was heading to.
No.
Yes.
Yeah.
They said it about the commander, and then that's what gave Doolittle the idea to surf into the atmosphere, isn't it?
No.
I agree, but let's move on.
No, we'll settle it now. No, I think they don't make much reference to Powell floating off. He just flies by, and they talk about... Like, I think there's a sense that, Doolittle might land the planet and he can live there, but he'll die burning up in the atmosphere, but at least he's going to get his surfing, and that's why he flashes and disappears at the end, because he's burnt up.
That is what happens to him. I still disagree about what was said.
Well, let's rewatch the film and be more accurate. Let's not worry about accuracy. We've all been a smidge vague because unfortunately we did watch the film and then not get to record straight away. So there was little elements that we've been a little bit, did that all right? Maybe we've all just gone stir crazy from watching the film, being with them on this journey.
Mm.
Who knows? But it's a really funny and creative film. I really like it, and I can totally see its influence on straight sci-fi, like Alien. Obviously, it is a prototype for that. It's been influential, even if you haven't known it, on so many things. And I'm grateful for it because it meant it gave us several great seasons of Red Dwarf, which all seem to fit in that world. I almost can believe that they're two different, like, they're different companies in the same concept, really, aren't they? You can imagine a world where, like, Red Dwarf bumps into Dark Star and has, like, a conversation before moving on. Even though that might
defy
the point.
I'm really sad
that
isn't going to happen now.
Well, in a way, it wouldn't make sense because, like, David Lister from Red Dwarf would have met other humans. That would spoil the whole point of him never discovering humans again. So...
It could have been before, I guess.
Oh, yeah, but yeah, when they were both like, yeah, I want it to be part of the same universe. So in my mind it is, because it's very much the same tone. But yes, I mean, it's a cracking film, so good. I'm glad you brought it to us.
Right at the end, Hugh, I just want to bring up one distracting thing from the film.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, some of the special effect shots, like of the ship travelling through space...
Or the electricity or something.
Yeah. Was a little distractingly poor. but like you said at the beginning, once you kind of know the kind of level of effort that's gone to it and such little money, even those, you know, standout distracting effects, you forgive.
Yeah, I think on Wikipedia, I think one of the writers, what's his face? Not John Carpenter, but...
Dan O'Bannon.
I think Dan O'Bannon said of it, it was almost a shame they added to it to make it into a feature length, because as it was a really great student film, probably one of the best made ever. But then making it into a feature length, now it's one of the shittest sci-fis. So it's like, that's the dichotomy of it, really. Is it's, you know, too cheap to be brilliant, but phenomenal considering how cheap it is. Yeah, I mean, fair play.
Yeah, and it must have been. Like, it's hard to comprehend now, because we weren't born till like a good 10 years after this was made. But I imagine, like, the people who saw this at the time, it would have left quite the impact. Like, because, you know, after the moon landings and stuff like that, space travel were all about hope and about discovery and optimism. Finding things, and and like this film is just the total opposite of that, and like it would have stood out at the time.
Yeah, I think in many ways, if we could explore space as we have done in the way that sci-fi like Star Trek does, where it's explore the universe, colonize, spread, find out things about life. I think the reality is it would be quite boring because so much of space is empty and devoid of anything interesting. You know, it wouldn't be the endlessly finding cool planets with interesting aliens. That's why we haven't met any properly in our world, as far as we know. Like, we don't meet life. Aliens are probably mostly in people's minds and a myth because it would take ages and eventually you'd find life and it wouldn't be anything close to as interesting as you wanted. It would just be either understandable or just subtle, like a literally moss or something. And then, you know, I don't know. But there's so much of space to explore would be underwhelming. And I think, in a way, it's a fair estimation of what the future could be like for exploration of space anyway.
And if you take like what Abby said earlier on, how this is a kind of counterpoint to submarine
movies.
I don't know what point I was going to make there. Never mind.
If it's drawing on, you know, submarine movies, it's got an accuracy. It's got that stir. It's got a believability because yeah, they're sitting in a you know submarine underwater doing nothing for ages.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's essentially how it would go. Like, you know, you're just in a small, hot boat with lots of people and, you know, how it is.
Just each other's
food. I think you're trying to say it. If space exploration happened, it would more likely be like this than Star Trek.
It would require jobbers to sit there endlessly bored and technically doing something important for science, but fundamentally just killing time. It's huge. The universe is huge and very, very empty. So it would logically take a long time to navigate through it. And that would lead to just stir crazy losers. And that's why this makes sense in many ways. But yeah, Abby, do you want to go first with final thoughts and a metaphor?
Yeah, my final thought is just I like the attitude of it where they are in a really shitty situation and you do basically know how it's going to end. But at the same time, they do keep going. They don't do it in the way that they're supposed to, but they don't exactly give up either. So there's this sort of endurance of human spirit at the same time.
Yeah, it's like they don't know what else to do with their lives. It's not like they got something better to do.
And then for my metaphor, I think it was something we watched relatively recently. So it's maybe They Live, or it was with the weird underground bit that we didn't know why it was there.
And then, we did A Boy and His Dog.
But it's one of those, you get it where there's like a can of beer, but it's not branded. It's just grey and it says beer.
How do you mean it's like that?
It's a joke that's so simple and so straightforward, but it still works.
It's like a low budget, simple joke. It's just a observation and a and that's it. There you go.
Yeah.
So you're saying
I might have another one in a minute.
Okay. Because I can't quite work much more. Like, I'm not sure I fully understand how it's like that's how like the film is, other than it's good. Like you're saying, it's good and it's simple, but you can think longer if you want to.
Alternatively, I tried rice cake in college recently, and it was
the go-to.
No, but it was Metcalf's rice cakes made with rice. There's just that addendum of made with rice that made me stare at it for a little while and go,
well, it could have been made from cakes. Box
exactly. But I feel like this has got a similar thing. But they do it in a humour way.
So it's just a simplistic, funny joke. It's just laugh at the absurdity of the scenario they're in.
And the minimalism of it as well.
Yeah, like this is very aesthetic. Minimal. Yeah, because it's so low budget. They're working with the bare basics of what they can. They're making a lot. They're making a nice rice cake out of some simple rice. I don't know. Okay, well, I'm going to go for. I mean, I like it. I think it's great. Love it. There are problems, mainly down to hokiness and the budget. But that doesn't matter in the slightest, because it's just a way of expressing a narrative. It doesn't matter if it doesn't look right. I get what they're going for, so benefit of the doubt. I get it. Yeah, yeah. It's a spaceship in space. If it looks like a photograph, or it's like looks like a model, or if certain bit, I get it. Electric storm, right? It doesn't matter. And so to me, it's like the kind of the first car you ever have, and it's cheap and shit, and it's falling apart, and it like it's got all the quirks. Like I had a car where the speedometer broke, but I got pretty good at guessing the speed. Don't recommend it. Like one, your back wiper doesn't work. One of your wing mirrors is sort of loose and taped. Like there's a hole in the carpet inside. It's got all these problems. The radiation shielding is not working. You know, you got a frozen man in the boot. It's your car. You've lived in it. You've had it for ages. You understand its quirks. You know how to get it from first into third gear because second gear doesn't work. You know, you've become used to it. You like all the parts that are wrong. And you don't care that it's shit and cheap. It's your car. And it's, like, special to you. And I think that's what this is to me. It's, like, it's shit and cheap, but it's just right for me, you know?
Mm.
My cup of tea. So that's what I'm saying. Or, you know, it's a rice cake. Whichever. Anthony?
Yeah, I don't know if there's much else to say. I really enjoyed the film. It both met and, like, outshone my expectations. Like, coming in, like I said, I was hoping it would remind me of Douglas Adams and Red Dwarf, and it did. And if you're fans of those guys, then I think you will get a lot from this film. I don't really know how to add to what you've just said, Richard. Like, you just kind of summed it up perfectly.
I mean, but like other people might get in my car and think, this is shit. This is the worst car I've ever been in. And they'd find it irritating and frustrating. I can definitely see that with this film. Is some people would be like, it was boring. Oh, it's so sad and depressing, you know?
Yeah, there's that angle as well. The only other angle I'd come from is that... if I was going to go for a metaphor, maybe something that was more influential than people realise, because like this film, I think, is. But I can't think of an example.
Like Alien is this. This was like the triggering idea. Oh, we played around and we made this film, and that gave. That created the kernel or the seed for Alien that went on to be like an amazing classic sci-fi.
Mm.
Had loads of sequels.
But kind of unsung, because I don't think many people know about Dark Star.
And no one goes, oh, you like Alien and Aliens and Aliens Cubed, then you love Dark Star. It doesn't... I'm sure you'd love watching Dark... man fight an inflatable ball.
Dark Star is like the soldier. Let this play. Dark Star is like the soldier of the troop, whereas things like Aliens and Blade Runner are the commanders. So, like, they'll take all the glory when it comes to the time, but really, like, this is the soldiers that have done all the work and are the most kind of pivotal to have beaten like the battle. But they're not going to get as much recognition as the commanders are going to get, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, you're right. You know, Patton may have been the general and told people what to do and where to go, but back at the beginning was Darkstar pulling the trigger there on the battlefield, so...
Mm.
Yeah, I think that's a fair metaphor.
Abby, just when Anthony was looking for one, I was going to suggest it was like MySpace.
Okay.
Because it's one of the pioneers of social media, but now a lot of people don't even know that it ever existed.
Yeah.
I still have some fond memories of the early days of MySpace and fucking around with the backgrounds, even though you're not meant to technically, and you learned some stuff and played around with MySpace. It had its moment in the sun. So maybe it is a bit like MySpace, defunct, low quality and forgotten, but still a key part of the history, I suppose, yeah.
Mm.
Yes, that's all right, Abby. I think that's getting more. I think getting a clearer understanding. We're getting to a better metaphor. Because I think, you know, I didn't quite understand your first ones, and now I think we got a better one to hang our thoughts off of, if that makes sense. I don't know what I'm saying now. Hang our thoughts off of it. Anyway, I'm going to hang...
We've all lost interest and gone stir crazy now.
I think that, you know, if anything's going to happen, our podcast will float in space forever. No one listening to it. Just like on Earth. But just floating around like a celestial being. Just there. Weird. Out there. I don't know what I'm on about. I'm genuinely going stir crazy. I feel that's time... Good a time as any to set off the bomb and end the podcast. Anyone want to persuade it otherwise? 30 more minutes of chat.
Oh, come on, podcast, don't end. Like, there's so much more we could dig up about John Carpenter.
No, there isn't. We're dead. Podcast over.
You'd be so difficult to talk around if you were a bomb.
I'd be so vindictive, and yeah, I don't
know. Anthony, I'd be able to talk to. He'd be reasonable, but you, no.
I would. I'd be very easy to talk to.
Oh, I don't know. I could be quite stubborn at times.
You know, an exploding bomb yourself, Abby.
Bitch.
Oh, and the line you were looking for earlier, Rich.
Yes. Like,
now it's time to go to sleepy bye, you worthless piece of garbage.
Yeah, go, now it's time to sleepy bye. That's good. And you worthless piece of garbage is fair point, because it is a painted beach ball with weird... Thank you for that. Anyway, there we go. Actually, one thing I forgot to mention was that weird makeshift instrument that Doolittle played. There was just sort of weird objects all hanging about and maybe some water in it, and just a weird percussion instrument where you turn things and press things, and that didn't make any sense. But fair play, John Carpenter. You have done a lot of strange things with sound, so kudos. Just thought I'd add that on, because I forgot about it. So, bye.